Drugs.ie podcast.
Education and information.
Welcome to the latest drugs.ie podcast. This episode was recorded in October 2008 at the Community Awareness of Drugs 25th Anniversary Training Day for community workers. The podcast features two talks given during the course of the day. The first talk is from Johnny Kelly of the Health Research Board. This talk presents recent research findings from the Health Research Board report entitled Crack Cocaine in the Dublin Region, an Evidence Base for a Crack Cocaine Strategy. The report can be downloaded from the research section of drugs.ie. The second talk is from Dr. Des Corrigan and is entitled Herbal Highs, a New Challenge for Family Drug Prevention.
Thank you very much. I just put that on because I think it's a little bit difficult to hear right at the back. And we had the launch of the report yesterday on a ship, the Eli Etna on the Liffey, and people at the back, we were in a little hangar where they used to keep the helicopter, and people at the back couldn't hear, but nobody told me. So anyway, it was a bit like talking to, like a priest at Mass. Everyone at the back is having their own conversation. But, well, thanks a lot for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be here. And what I'm going to do basically is just talk you through the main findings of the research that we've done over the last about year and a half or so, the background to it, how we did it, what we found, and the implications of the research. And if it's, I won't be, I think I've got more than half an hour, I won't be that long. So I'd appreciate any feedback that I can get or any questions or anything like that, because when you do research like this, it is very, there's been a lot of media coverage, but it is very good to get a bit of feedback from people who are working in the field, it's very useful for me. Just also to acknowledge that this, like all of the work we do in the Health Research Board, it's basically the product of the labour of many, just acknowledge that my co-authors and researchers, Sinead Foran, Anne-Marie Donovan, Anne-Marie Carew, and Jean Long. Now, we have in Ireland, I suppose, when we first heard of crack, I think we sort of had an image that we imported in many ways from the United States. Of crack users and crackheads and these sorts of expressions and terms, and also from the United Kingdom, which has had a major problem with crack cocaine since the late 1980s, early 1990s. It's sort of remarkable in a way that it's only very recently that that we are beginning to see a bit of a crack problem in Ireland, given that our nearest neighbour has had such a problem for so long. In Ireland, there was very limited occasional reports of crack use, either coming through reports of the Gardaí, crack seizures very occasionally in the 1990s, or from treatment services, again, very occasionally. But since 2004, there has been an increase in the reporting of crack cocaine. In the North Inner City in particular, in and around 2005, there was a number of reports of crack, and there was a number of seizures made by the Gardaí in the North Inner City. This led them to set up an operation, a policing operation called Operation Plaza, which set basically around the northeast inner city, where a number of crack dealers were investigated, prosecuted, etc. And that led to an organisation called the Community Policing Forum, or the North Inner City Community Policing Forum. This was something that was established in 1999 to bring together the local community, Dublin City Council, the Gardaí, and other various sort of stakeholders in terms of responding at a very local level to the various community policing issues in relation to drugs that were had arisen in the area. A very successful initiative in an area that has not generally enjoyed very positive police community relations. This new initiative set up underneath the auspices of the local drugs task force was set up. I'm going to talk a little bit about this again later on, but under the national drug strategy, every drug task force area is supposed to develop a community policing forum. Under the Garda Síochána Act of 2005, we have had the establishment of joint policing committees, and these will also are empowered to establish local policing fora. So for the first time really in the history of the state, you have the setting up of a sort of an infrastructure with a statutory basis in terms of community policing, and I'll come back to that because it's very important. And the community policing forum set up the intersectoral crack cocaine strategy group, which was chaired by Tony Gregory, TD, and brought together the Department of Justice, the Gardaí, Customs, the City Clinic, the Health Services Executive, the National Drug Strategy Team, ISHCA, which is the Drug Users Forum in the North Inner City, the Health Research Board, the Local Drugs Task Force, the Inner City Organisation Network, and the North Wall Residents Association. So a multi-agency, multi-sectoral, community-based, community-focused initiative was established. The first thing that they did was they asked the Health Research Board to put together an evidence base upon which they could develop a strategy to get a real, clear, objective picture of the crack cocaine problem in the Dublin region. This was an initiative I had encouraged them to do. It was something that had been developed also in London under the former Lord Mayor Ken Livingstone, where they set up a London evidence base for their crack cocaine strategy. So what you had was you had the evidence being directly linked into the formation of a strategy. So we got funding from the Department of Justice, from their policy and research unit, to do this study. And we adopted a model, or a methodology, called Rapid Situation Assessment Technique. This is something that was developed by the World Health Organization. And often in developing countries, it is used to try and go into a place, get a quick picture of the situation so you can come up with an emergency type of response. It's a sort of a multi-source approach where you use various sources in a short time frame and you can it's what's called triangulation of methods, so you can compare findings across different sources. So what we did was we spoke to drug users, to people who were using crack or who had formerly used crack. We spoke to Gardaí. We spoke to treatment people working in the treatment area. We spoke to outreach workers. We held focus groups with the Garda Drugs Unit, with treatment specialists, with drug users. And then we used other data, available data, such as criminal justice data, police seizure data. And then we used a lot of data from the National Drug Treatment Reporting System, which you might be familiar with, which is maintained by the Health Research Board. Everyone who gets treatment in Ireland for drug use, we would get data on that, and so we had all available that sort of data as well. Now there was a number of limitations with the data which I've described in the report, and those limitations we could have a clearer picture of the situation if there was an improvement both in health data and in police recorded data, particularly on the Pulse, the police data information system. It's called Pulse. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. There could be improvements, and we could get a better picture. But still, it was a very quite a thorough, in-depth analysis in a short space of time. The aim of the research was firstly to establish the nature and extent of crack use in the Dublin region, and what we did was we used all of the drug task force areas, so we focused on all of the task force areas, to identify the impact both for the individual, for their family, and for the broader community, to look at the responses both in terms of treatment and in terms of law enforcement, with a view to putting together a document which could feed into the formation of a strategy, a timely strategy. What's going to happen actually in January of next year, I think it's on the 20th of January, is that there will be a conference in Croke Park, which will be based on the report, where all the various stakeholders will come together and look at ways of responding to it. And we also provided in the appendices to the document, there is two evidence-based analyses. One is of treatment responses to cocaine and crack use. What is best practice? What is international evidence telling us? And the other is looking at crack law enforcement initiatives that was done by criminologists in Australia. So that is there as a sort of a, what does the international evidence say? What are we finding in Dublin? And also what is the international evidence telling us? So what is crack? Well, crack is it's powder where powder cocaine is dissolved in water, and then an alkali such as ammonia or bicarbonate is added to it, and it is heated. It solidifies into small little they're called rocks, but they're not exactly rocks. They're very generally like half a thumbnail would be what would be smoked. So it's very small little pebbles. And when they are heated, then they give off this crackling sort of noise, and that's where the name crack comes from. It produces about a 2 minute very intense high, and this then levels off into a sort of a pleasurable feeling for about 20 minutes or so. This is the sort of paraphernalia that is associated with the use of crack cocaine. It can be smoked using, for example, the coke can, this sort of makeshift, that Volvic bottle, the sort of make where a tube is put in and it's burnt on the top. So that is sort of give you, and it can also be injected. And many of the service providers we spoke to, health, weren't aware that crack can also be injected. It can cause a lot of damage in that way. Also, I should point out that while you might add things like ammonia or sodium bicarbonate, also whatever is mixed with the original cocaine powder will also be within the overall mix. So, why has crack emerged recently in Ireland? Well, the first point, of course, is the increased availability of powder cocaine, which I'm sure we're all very familiar with. There was a report just published the day before yesterday by the National Advisory Committee on Drugs, which again sort of enhanced our picture and showed, as is happening in every other European country, a very large growth in the availability of cocaine. And in Ireland, there's no difference in Ireland in that respect. We've also, another possible factor is the return from the UK and elsewhere in Europe of opiate users, primarily heroin users, who have used crack elsewhere. Thirdly, a new supply of crack linked primarily to non-Irish nationals, possibly with supply routes from West Africa. Most cocaine comes to Europe from the Andean Peninsula, from cocaine. Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia are the primary sort of coca producing countries. And then it comes up through the Andean, or up through the Iberian Peninsula, through Spain, where most cocaine seizures are made in Europe, and into Ireland that way. There has been a new sort of route has opened up through West Africa as well. It's not as major a route, but there is a new route up through West Africa as well. So what we found from the research, this was supported both by the Garda operations, and by crack users that we spoke to, that the primary dealers were West Africans. Now the users didn't say West Africans; they used different terminology, which is in the report. But it is clear that it was primarily West Africans. Now that is not to say that now crack is being dealt; it's more broader now throughout Dublin. But originally the market was in the north inner city, and it was primarily controlled, it seemed, or I wouldn't say controlled, but it was primarily West Africans who were dealing. For many users, they perceived West Africans as better able to prepare crack. While many could prepare it themselves, they felt that West Africans did it better, they produced more purer forms, etc. So that is something I'd like to talk about. I know there was a question about that earlier on, and it's something I want to talk a little bit about, because it's a very difficult thing to report, but you don't want to produce a racist charter. The vast majority of people dealing and using drugs in Ireland are Irish nationals, but of course when the evidence is telling you something, it also tells you a lot about the nature of the illicit drug market. It is a global market, and there are sources and people, there are different cultures, etc., and that's something that we need to just be aware of and address. And then finally, as I mentioned, that it was the perception was that these dealers were better able to produce better quality crack. So what is the extent of crack use? Crack use is low, but it is increasing. Users represent 1% of treated problem drug users reporting to the National Drug Treatment Reporting System, and 0.1% of the general population. That's in 2006-2007. The number of cases presenting for treatment began to reach double figures in 2003. Since 2004, treatment services in every task force area throughout Dublin reported at least one case of crack cocaine. And the experience in other countries in the UK and elsewhere is that when a crack market is stabilises or establishes itself, it can escalate extremely quickly, in an 18-month period, in a very rapid escalation. So in this slide, what we are saying is that you cannot over-exaggerate the problem and you can't be complacent about the problem. But it is important to be measured in terms of, it is not a, crack isn't everywhere. And it's not, it's important to have a realistic sense of the situation. But that doesn't mean that you don't respond at the beginning. And one of the reasons why the Intersexual Crack Cocaine Strategy Group were so concerned about crack when it emerged was because of the experience that they've had with heroin. In the North Inner City over a 30-year period, and the widespread perception that this was allowed to fester, this problem was allowed to fester before there was really a strategy put in place. And with crack, they don't want that to happen. They want there to be an immediate reaction. This is just an indicator of seizures made by and reported by the Gardaí from 2000 to 2006. It just shows the clear upwards trajectory. And Garda seizures are generally seen as a sort of an indicator of drug availability. Now, it should also be pointed out that there is a general rule of thumb that about between 10 to 20% of the total amount of drugs available at any time are actually seized. So that's quite a small figure. So if that is what has been seized, what is available obviously is going to be multiple of that. What is out there in the in society is going to be a lot higher than that, obviously. So another thing we try to investigate, my background is in criminology, and I'm particularly interested in the criminological aspects of the whole drug issue. And particularly to look at, when we talk about the drug problem, or I would view it in terms of looking at a market, which has, it's not like any ordinary market, but it does have a certain market logic. There is supply, there is demand, there are prices, there's purity levels, etc. And when you view it like that, you can, it opens up other ways of analysing and other ways of responding to it. So as I mentioned, despite Garda operations, the North Inner City still appears to be the main market for crack cocaine. Current crack markets are what we would refer to as closed markets. That means that generally buyers will only sell to people that they know. Exchanges are generally made by mobile phones. Sometimes no hand-to-hand exchanges aren't made. So that frustrates police buy bust operations, where a police undercover buys some drugs and then there's a bust of the seller. When you don't actually physically exchange the drugs, that obviously makes that a lot more difficult, impossible actually. And then you have people being sent to other parts of the city to pick up their drugs, so there's a complete separation between the dealer and the actual drug itself. So these are what we call closed market features. It's not like an open street market where people can just walk up to anyone on the street and buy or sell. As I mentioned, I've already mentioned that point about users believing non-Irish dealers prepared higher quality crack. The price is relatively stable and uniform at around 50 to 100 euros for quantity, or rocks, and these small amounts, it's like half a fingernail, which I think would be about five to ten doses of crack. Now that's a very high price relative to other countries, relative to the north, relative to the UK and elsewhere. The price is quite high, and that's something I'm going to come back to later on. Drug dealing strategies used by are, for example, crack being sold at drug treatment centres and being sold to heroin users when people say they have no heroin but they do have crack. Being sold as sort of party packs with other drugs. These sort of devices are being used to try and to promote its use. Crack houses have been identified, but these are generally places where crack can be used, sometimes prepared in exchange for free crack. But they're generally not. We find they're generally not places where major dealing is happening or where there's sex work is happening, as is the experience in the UK or in the US, where crack houses are major centres of dealing, very heavily fortified with lookouts and all the rest of it. And that is not the case here, and that's a very important point. As I mentioned, when we hear of crack and we hear of crack houses, it's very easy to import this terminology from North America or from the UK, but it's not the way it's happening here. So we have to be careful about just the way in which terminology becomes used in public discourse. The profile of crack users in Dublin, their patterns of use, high levels of homelessness, high levels of unemployment, very limited formal education, with lifestyles that are often too chaotic to sustain legitimate income. The majority of crack users seeking treatment have already got a history of problematic opiate use, primarily heroin. The vast majority of users in treatment are polydrug users. 37%, about a fifth of crack users entering treatment, commenced its use before the age of 20. The involvement of young people is something I want to come back to because it's quite an important issue. A proportion of users may be young people who binge on crack but do not engage with treatment services. They don't see themselves as having a problem. They're not interested in engaging with treatment services, and they go on a sort of a weekend binge on crack. The most common crimes associated with crack to pay the high prices of crack would be shoplifting, burglary, robbery. There's an increase in the numbers of women returning to sex work or beginning sex work for the first time. This is an important finding. Many people who might have been opiate users in the past previously would not have engaged in sex work to fund their heroin use, but we are finding that they are doing that to fund crack use. And that is a very important finding. High numbers of, not necessarily there's more men than women we find using it, but women crack users do seem to be displaying more chaotic results or consequences, and that's an important thing we need to investigate further. The high prices of crack lead to debts, and the intimidation associated with these is now becoming a very serious issue in a lot of communities, as debts are the repayment of debts is not just sought from the user, but from their siblings, from the parents, from the family, and so the whole family is brought into this cycle. The most common physical side effects are breathing problems, heart problems, and rapid weight loss. The most common psychological consequences are paranoia, aggressiveness, and depression. Crack has always been associated with violence. Now, a lot of writers have said that this has been overplayed or has been exaggerated, and a lot of the violence is associated with the market, it's not necessarily psychopharmacological, it's not necessarily a consequence of the use of the drug, but the market itself. But what we are finding, and treatment providers said they do see a heightened levels of aggression, but they don't feel threatened. Treatment providers emphasise that to us, that yeah, there's slightly more aggression out there, but we don't feel threatened by it. They want to emphasise that. Many users, of course, because they have a history of problematic heroin use, will already have ill effects as a result of that history. Compulsive crack users report neglecting their children and diverting their financial resources into buying crack. And also, many of them said that they would use more crack if they could afford it. And that's an important point. So in terms of another thing we did in the study was we asked treatment providers what did they think was required in terms of developing a response. The current treatment responses that are there evolved primarily from problematic cocaine use. The Department of Health, Department of Community, Rural and Gaelic Affairs, Merchants Quay Ireland have provided resources, and they provided training for people in responding to crack, and we have detailed the provisions that are there. But some services do say that they feel that they are ill-equipped to deal with crack, with clients who present with crack problems. There's also a widespread perception in Dublin that treatment centres are only about dispensing methadone. That perception is very strong, and it's out there. Some service providers and some crack users said that they needed separate facilities to deal with cocaine use, sort of stimulant-only facilities. A problem with this, however, is that most crack users, as I mentioned, are polydrug users. So they're using opiates and they're using crack. And also another issue that we found is that some crack users' lifestyles are too chaotic to allow regular attendance at treatment centres. And also some users in treatment for heroin, for opiates, did not report crack, either because of fears of sanctions under the methadone protocol or because they feared losing their children. So there's a population out there that we don't know about, and they are not talking about their drug use for fear of negative consequences. And obviously that is something we need to look at. The first point to make is crack can be treated. We have provided an evidence base at the back. The most successful approaches are psychosocial interventions, cognitive behavioural therapy. And generally, I'm not sure if people are familiar with this. I'm not really myself. I'm not an expert in the area. But really what it seems to me, or what it is about, it's trying to help the user address their own life circumstances that is putting them into a situation where they feel they need to depend on drugs. Help them with lifestyle issues, homelessness, unemployment, family problems, and assist in building up self-esteem. These are the sort of interventions that are there. And those immediate new needs, issues around homelessness or employment, they need to be addressed if you're going to retain somebody in treatment. And also people need to be incentivized and encouraged to come into treatment. So for example, if they feel that there's going to be negative consequences of reporting their crack use, that's not an incentive to come into treatment. So that has to be addressed. And how are you going to bring them in to treatment? And this is a major issue, of course, for outreach. Complementary therapies, acupuncture, massage, and personal development programs are seen as the way forward. And there's a possible need for more all-encompassing services involving outreach and psychosocial treatment, with the addition of medical interventions, for example, methadone prescription or detoxification for alcohol and illicit drugs. So in the meeting that will happen in January, these are the sort of issues that we will need to talk about and hammer out. As I mentioned, crack markets are resilient and they are adaptable. While law enforcement initiatives such as Operation Clean Street might lead to the prosecution of a number of users or dealers, it will also, on its own, lead to their displacement of markets elsewhere in the city. That is not to say it's not important, but there is a high demand there, there is huge profits that can be made, so the market is not going to go anywhere, really. If a dealer is arrested or imprisoned, he or she will be very quickly replaced with somebody else. So intensive enforcement activity can, as I say, just simply lead on its own to the displacement of the market. The risk management strategies that are used by dealers to avoid arrest make law enforcement more complicated in this area. The emergence of crack houses makes street level activity obviously less visible. But at the same time, the high prices do seem to be deterring people from use. If there was a huge supply of crack, if you applied basic market logic, you would imagine the prices would come down. Prices are relatively high and they are stable, and this is operating as a disincentive to people to use further crack. There are also, amongst users, there is still a stigma associated with crack. That again, we have probably imported in our sort of subconscious from the States and elsewhere. You know, I might use drugs, but I'm not a crackhead. I might use drugs, but I'm not a junkie. This sort of stigma is there, and that has, I think, a benefit in terms of prevention strategies, education strategies, etc. What is it that makes people say, I'll use those drugs, but I won't use those drugs? And that's something we need to look at. In terms of policing responses, concentrated law enforcement can be very useful because the police can divert resources very quickly and they can target them. But in terms of disrupting markets that emerge, particularly in relation to something like crack cocaine, so that is important. But it must be done in combination with treatment, where if you arrest people or you imprison people, there needs to be supports. There needs to be supports for families, there needs to be support. If you want to divert them into treatment, there need to be places available, and you need to work hand in hand. And this sort of approach is now seen as really the way forward. One thing that we are seeing from the National Drug Treatment Reporting System is that the amount of people coming from criminal justice agencies into treatment centres, one of the questions asked of people is, where did you come from? Who sent you to treatment? Some people say, oh, well, I came myself, my family sent me, or the police, the guards sent me. We're finding very low numbers of people in treatment saying that they're there, they've been diverted by the police, and that is an issue that needs to be looked at. International evidence shows us that partnership working is the most sustainable method of responding to street-level drug markets. So things like the intersectoral crack cocaine strategy group, like the community policing forum I mentioned, are seen internationally as really the best way forward. No one agency or community has all of the answers, and so working together really is the way forward. Under the Garda Act, we now have the setting up of joint policing committees throughout the country, and under the Act and under the National Drug Strategy, local drugs task forces will be setting up community policing fora in all the task force areas. And they provide an infrastructure which brings together agencies with local communities to sort of deliver responses like this. In conclusion then, the research shows that crack use is low, but it is increasing. That international experience show the importance of a timely response. Crack use can be treated, and partnership approaches are the most sustainable way forward. So, Gurmagav, August, if you want a copy of the report, you can get it online at the HOB there, at that website address. So, thanks for listening, and if you have any questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My apologies that I couldn't be with you this morning, but we had a full meeting of the NACD, the National Advisory Committee, this morning. So I was glad to be able to make it at some stage during the day, because I'm a particular fan of the CAD approach to things. But just thought I might tell you about two things that we actually looked at this morning that's coming down the tracks, two reports that we're looking at. They're not quite finished yet, so they're not quite ready for publication, because we've had quite a spate of publications. The cocaine bulletin on Tuesday, and then fortnight previously, the Rosie thing. But we're looking at a major study on early school leaving and drugs, and we're still at the final stages of doing the field work on that. And then the other one is, which looks as if it's going to be a major report, is drugs and prostitution. And we hope to have that available, certainly the final report available to us before Christmas. Those are the sort of things that we're working on. As I said, I'm pleased to be here because coincidentally, both CAD and myself mark a particular milestone in our involvement in the drugs phenomenon. CAD is 25 years in existence, and I've already had the opportunity on Saturday to pay tribute to the work of CAD and to say again just how important it is in terms of helping so many families and so many individuals over the last 25 years. The milestone for me is that I discovered to my horror that it is 40 years since I first got involved in the drugs area, when in 1968, when the then Sergeant Dinny Mullins set up a drug squad for the first time. And how I got involved was that we provided the analysis for the drug squad at that stage, identifying all of the drugs that were being seized. And we did that for about 13 years. And the reason why we got involved, my colleagues and I in the School of Pharmacy in Trinity got involved way back in 1968, was because of our particular academic expertise. And one of the problems as an academic is that you actually learn more and more about less and less. You specialize. And my specialist area, and the reason why my colleagues and I got involved, is in the study of medicinal plants, of drug plants. And most of our drugs that are misused come from plant materials or are easily made from plant materials. But I've had very much a twin-track approach to the study of medicinal plants. One has been looking at the harmful side from a recreational point of view. The other has been looking at the more positive side, the use of plants in herbal medicine. And this topic and the emergence of this as an issue of concern, the whole area of herbal highs being sold through the head shops, is a sort of very strange coming together of the two strands of my working life. I never thought the two of them would come together. I rather hoped that they wouldn't, but they have come together. Now, so I've been involved in the whole area of herbal drugs. And of course, for me, the herbal drug would be the drugs produced from the leaves of this plant, the cannabis plant, both as cannabis as a medicine, as a herbal drug, and cannabis as a recreational drug. And I've been studying this plant for 40 years, since 1968. And the more I learn about it, and I've recently written a chapter on cannabis for the EMCDA, the EU's drugs agency, called the EMCDDA, and that's another resource if you need resources. It's based in Lisbon, and they produced what they call a cannabis reader. It takes some reading, it's 700 pages long, but it is packed full of the most up-to-date information on all aspects of cannabis that anybody could want, even the most ardent anorak like myself could want. But the point I'm making is the more I study this plant, the more concerned I am about its impact on human beings and on human health. None of my concerns have been any lessened over the last 4 years, or 40 years. The most recent update we have, it comes from a guy called Wayne Hall. He's an Australian, and he's recognized as one of the world's leading experts on cannabis. And Wayne wrote this article in the International, and it's one of the most respected journals in the whole drugs area internationally. It's a journal called Addiction, during the summer. And he said that teenagers who use cannabis, that one in six of them are likely to develop dependence, whereas for adults it's 1 in 10. And this is because the teenage brain, to quote somebody else, is a work in progress. And early involvement of cannabis in that situation means more likely development of dependence. More likely to use other drugs, particularly cocaine, based on the Dutch experience. Perform very poorly at school, leave school early and be on welfare, and have a very poor life relationship. And we know that from studies from the Netherlands, studies from Australia, and studies from New Zealand in particular, where they've been following up a group of young people from the day they were born, and they're now 25. And they've come to the conclusion that those teenagers that used cannabis while they were adolescents had very poor outcomes in life because of the impact of cannabis on learning and memory. And that doesn't even take account of the risk of accidents associated with cannabis, the risk of respiratory lung problems related to the fact that cannabis is smoked. And then the other area where the research is showing us is the one that Kevin Madigan touched on this morning in relation to the psychiatric symptoms and disorders linked to cannabis use. And what Wayne Hall also indicated was that, for example, in the Netherlands and in Britain, there has been very strong debate about the link between particularly the school problems and the mental health problems associated with cannabis and the strength of cannabis, particularly the increasing strength of cannabis. And we measure the strength of cannabis in terms of just one of the 500 different chemicals in the plant, THC, the major psychoactive material, the thing that gives you the high when you either eat cannabis or smoke it. Now, we have very limited information about the strength of cannabis on the Irish market. It is much stronger than it used to be, but it is a hell of a lot weaker than what is currently available in the Netherlands, where the Dutch have managed to produce what they call netherweed. They also call it Dutch weed or skunk type cannabis.
And excuse me, I just thought I'd pop this in here just for people at the back. Okay. Somebody said it to me at the break and I just didn't get a chance to do it. Is that still okay for you?
Yeah. Where we know from the laboratory studies that skunk type cannabis is now in the Netherlands averaging 20% THC. And the hash, what they call nether hash, produced from that particular type of cannabis is 37% THC. So that's where the linkages is being made between the increasing strength of that cannabis and some of the school, the learning problems and the mental health problems. Now, how have the Dutch managed to get from basically 2% THC up to 20% THC? Well, they've done it by selecting high-strength seeds, skunk-type seeds, that will produce between 15 and 20% THC on average. Then they use a particular technique that is beloved of feminists, because cannabis plants exist as separate male and female plants. The female plant produces more THC than the male. So in this particular technique, all of the male plants are destroyed. That's why I said it's a feminist's dream. And only the female plants are allowed to produce the THC undisturbed by any male interfering with their parts, shall we say. Okay. The other element is that they use, instead of using clay or soil to grow the plants in, they use liquid, what's called hydroponic cultivation, where you use a nutrient liquid to grow the plants in. And then you use intense lighting and intense heat to mature the plants and to ensure that they produce a significant quantity of drug molecules within that plant. Now, the head shops that have, if you'll pardon the pun, and it is intentional, that have mushroomed around the country, facilitate this. They do it by, well, I suppose, instead of saying how they do it, I'll explain what I mean by the term head shop. Another word that's used is a smart shop, or a smart store, or a grow shop. And these are both retail and internet web-based outlets that sell psychoactive mood-altering plants, so-called legal highs, and so-called herbal highs. And I say so-called herbal highs because many of them are mixtures of herbs and synthetic drugs, which are not herbal in the way I define herbal. And they as well as that, they sell drug paraphernalia, different types of rolling papers, smoking papers, different types of skins, and also the growing equipment. So there are a variety of these. I'm beginning to lose track of the number of these. In fact, on Saturday I was told about one in Bray and one in Kilkenny that had recently opened up. So I'm adding to that list all the time. And they're spread right throughout the country. They're not just a Dublin, Temple Bar, Capel Street phenomenon. You find them all over the country. And a lot of them have associated websites where if you can't get into the store itself, you can actually order the material over the internet and sent by mail order. So what they're doing is they're selling the seeds of skunk-type cannabis. This is high-strength cannabis that You can see that white glistening thing. Can you make it out from where you are? These are the little glands on the leaf of the cannabis plant that actually produce the drug, produce the THC. And the idea of these type of seeds is you get an awful lot more of these glands in skunk-type cannabis, so therefore you get a much higher level of THC. So they're selling these. For example, this is one website linked to head shop in Dundalk and Drogheda, magicbus.ie. They're selling what's called White Widow. It's one of the strains. There's a whole variety of them. White Widow is one. Purple Haze, Northern Lights, Early Girl, Afghan Number One. A whole variety of different, I think there's about 150 different skunk-type seeds. And you'll see the price is €105 for 10 seeds. So it's about €10 per seed. Now you might think that's very expensive, but when you work out that the average cannabis plant produces enough leaf material for 1,000 joints, you can see that, in fact, that is not an expensive way forward. Another one is another group of seeds. Another one would be Thai Widow from a whole variety of Dutch sources of these seeds. And then they also sell you the equipment, the hydroponic equipment, the lighting and heating equipment that you can use to produce skunk-type cannabis. Now, the reason why they can do this is that cannabis seeds are not illegal. They're not controlled under the Misuse of Drugs Act, which specifically excludes seeds of cannabis plants. And the reason for that is that one type of cannabis plant is what we call hemp, that doesn't produce any THC. And that is sold as bird seed. And to my surprise, the last time I was in Dunn's, I saw a whole range of these superfoods ranging from linseed to goji berries, and then hemp seed on sale as a superfood because of the especially quite healthy oil, fatty oil that these seeds produce. And not only that, but you can actually grow hemp under license from the Department of Health and Children, and the EU will pay you a subsidy as long as it has less than 0.3% THC in it. In other words, there isn't enough THC to give you a high, no matter how much of this you actually smoked. But what we could do, because what these people are doing is walking a very thin tightrope of legality, because they offer you the seeds, they offer you the growing equipment, and then they have a little disclaimer saying it is illegal to grow cannabis in this country. But what we could do is to continue people to grow hemp, because it's a valuable thing for rope and for seed and for oil and things like that. It could be used as biofuel and things like that. But then remove the exemption for skunk type seeds, anything stronger than what would be allowed by the EU for subsidy purposes. Now, in addition to the skunk seeds and the growing equipment, the head shops also sell a range of drug paraphernalia, from grinders for grinding up your weed, for weighing scales, different types of ornamental, if I can put it like printed versions of Ritzler skins. They also sell blunts. And for those of you who led a sheltered life, a blunt is a hollowed out cigar into which you put your hash or your herb and then you smoke it. And then they sell these pipes, these ornamental pipes, water pipes, referred to as bongs, where the theory is that the water cools the smoke, but some of the research is indicating that it actually delivers more THC to the brain than you would get from an ordinary pipe or from a spliff or a joint. So that's what they're selling. Now, I use the pun word mushroom quite deliberately because these outlets came to public attention this time 3 years ago in relation to the controversy about the raw, the fresh magic mushrooms, the psilocybin mushrooms, and the subsequent banning of those mushrooms. Because The mushrooms were always illegal, but there was a technical loophole as to whether the fresh mushroom was included under the Misuse of Drugs Act. But many of the websites continue to offer mushroom growing kits, like this grow box for psilocybe cubensis, where they sell you the seeds or the spores of the mushroom, and then the soil, the growing medium that you need to grow the mushrooms. And I believe too that you can actually buy these over the counter, you can actually buy the mushroom spores, because they're not illegal. It's only illegal when you start growing the mushrooms in that situation. But they've moved on to selling other mushrooms as well. They sell this mushroom here, it's called fly agaric, or many of you will recognize it because it's a characteristic red top with the white speckles on it as the fairy toadstool. And most of us would run a million miles from that. We saw it growing wild in the woods and the countryside. But this mushroom, this fly agaric, there's two forms of it. One is called fly agaric itself. The other is panther cap. And it's botanically related to another mushroom called the death cap, which is, as the name suggests, fairly toxic. And these mushrooms, the fly agaric and the panther cap, contain two psychoactive molecules. Now, we don't need to worry about what they are, but they do affect the brain. And they cause hallucinations after about 30 minutes, quite powerful hallucinations, and an alcohol-like euphoria. And as ever, it's a sort of fairly consistent story with a lot of these materials, the question with hallucinations is always, what behavior happens while you lose contact with reality, while you're hallucinating, while you're tripping out? And this is the issue in relation to these particular mushrooms. And indeed, it will be a similar thing through virtually all of the materials I'm going to talk about over the next couple of minutes. What happens when you lose contact with reality? That's often, and it's the unpredictable mental behavior under the influence of these hallucinatory drugs, that's a key issue. So in addition to the mushrooms and the paraphernalia, the head shops selling these so-called legal highs and herbal highs. And in relation to the herbal highs, what they do is they label the products with the Latin botanical name of the plants that are in the thing, which is all very good if you're an anorak like me. And you recognize the fact when you see Ipomoea that it means a plant called morning glory that contains a natural form of LSD. The same with Argyraea nervosa, this beautiful English translation of the Hawaiian baby wood rose, also contains a natural form of LSD. Then you see passion flower and you think, oh, is it an aphrodisiac? Well, it's not. The term passion flower comes from the fact that the flowers of this plant represent the instruments that were used during Christ's passion and crucifixion. And that's why it's called passion flower. And it's actually quite an effective herbal tranquilizer. Another one, to put it, this other one, Eleutherococcus in, that's Siberian ginseng, so we wouldn't be worried about that because ginseng isn't particularly harmful to humans. And the other one they put in is a plant called, in the label, Paulina cupana. And if any of you have any of these products, if you've seen them in health food shops, and you're looking at this and you say, what the hell is in this? This doesn't give you an awful lot of information. But this Paulina is a South American, it's an Amazonian plant called guarana that is the highest natural source of caffeine. So it tells you that these products contain caffeine. Some of the others, a plant called Sweet Flag, is now banned for human use as a herbal medicine because it contains carcinogenic chemicals. And it's banned in the States for human medicine as a herbal medicine. the EU strictly limits the daily exposure to this particular plant because of the fact that it contains carcinogens. And there is no way that this particular plant material should be on open sale in so-called herbal hives because of the fact that it contains these carcinogens. Another one that features prominently on many of the products, and these are tablets and capsules and things like that, they look like medicines, is a thing called piper nigrum. Now, that mightn't mean anything to you, but if I say black pepper, then you recognize it. Because the chemical in black pepper is called piperine. This is the thing that gives the smell of black pepper and the taste of black pepper. The burning sensation of black pepper is from this particular chemical. And that's what they're putting in, and we'll see why, I hope, later on in the presentation. And the other one then is this almost unpronounceable one called Mitragyna, which is a plant called kratom. And I'll say a little bit more about kratom as we go on. One that appears prominently, this one, BX1, 100% pure stimulation, natural and pure Seda cordifolia extract. Okay, does that mean anything to anybody? Okay. Might do when I tell you that Seda cordifolia, the chemical, this plant, it's an Indian plant, produces ephedrine. And this is why it's in this particular product. Because that ephedrine comes from a Chinese plant called Ma Huang. It comes from Seda cordifolia, and you can also synthesize it. It's chemically similar to amphetamine. It's weaker, but similar to amphetamine, and it has the same kind of speed-like effects that you get with amphetamine. These are just some of the products, Speedos and Bliss Extra, and the packs are always very well designed, very well targeted towards young people. Strawberry Fields would be another one. Shrooms is another one that contains this Seda cordifolia. One of the disclaimers on the label is, for EX1, we make no health claims. But saying that something is a stimulant is making a health claim. And then we take no responsibility for the consequences of their use. Now, fundamental consumer law, consumer protection is that the seller and manufacturer of any product, it does have liability for the consequences of the use of the product. So they can't just put something on the label and say, we don't take any consequences for what happens to you if you use that product. They can't get away with that. Another one on Speedos is that it says, because it's sold as an ecstasy alternative, rehydrate yourself regularly, drinking lots of water or fruit juice, which was a harm reduction message that ended up killing people when they took ecstasy because of the fact that they were overdosing on water and dying from a water intoxication. So this is a dangerous message to have on the labels. So, as I said, ephedrine is a stimulant in the same way as amphetamine is. So you get stimulation, you get weight loss because, like amphetamine, it blocks appetite. You get dependence, psychological dependence, and you get psychosis and mania associated with ephedrine. Plus, then, it is potentially fatal because of the increased heart rate and blood pressure leading to heart attacks and strokes. Again, happens with any stimulant in that situation. Now, ephedrine itself is prescription only, and Ma Huang, the Chinese plant, is prescription only. And ephedrine is also legally controlled within the EU because it's used as what we call a precursor or a starter chemical for the synthesis of crystal meth. So the idea of having Seda cordifolia openly on sale over the counter is not something that is particularly helpful at the present time. The Morning Glories, again, these are some of the products, and you'll see some of the product names appearing more than once or twice because you're getting mixtures of different plants and mixtures of different chemicals and different plants in the different products. They're not pure herbal materials. They're often mixtures of the different materials. In fact, for strawberry fields, this is one website says that it's a blend of Ipoma, which is supposed to be Ipomea, Morning Glory, and BZP. I'll talk about BZP in a moment. And this is the first really viable alternative to the recently banned, very much missed, maybe by then, psilocybe magic mushrooms. So somebody asked me on Saturday when I talked about this, do these people know what they're selling? They know what they're selling. This is not by accident in any shape, way, shape or form. Okay. The other plant was the Hawaiian baby wood rose that also contains the seeds of these plants. And the thing about these seeds was that they were originally used in Mexico for religious purposes. Because, as I said, they contain LSD, or a natural form of LSD. So people were taking these primitive Mexican tribes, Indian tribes in Mexico, were taking these seeds. They were basically tripping out. And the only way they could interpret that or explain that was the gods appearing to them. And so sometimes, for example, the magic mushrooms were known in Aztec, for those of you who are fluent in Aztec, were known as flesh of the gods because of the religious connotations with these particular seeds. So again, these are the ones labelled as having Hawaiian baby wood rose in them. And the chemical is called LSA. It's lysergic acid amide, as opposed to LSD, lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD. And one of the other disclaimers on the Hawaiian baby wood rose seeds is not for human consumption, sold for botanical, horticultural, or herbarium specimen only. My eye. Okay. So, this LSA, this is the chemical in these seeds, the two seeds, the Morning Glory seeds and the Wood Rose seeds. It is the natural version, it's called LSA or lysergamide. It's not quite as powerful as LSD. But if you look at the comparative dose for heroin and ecstasy, and see just how potent these materials actually are. So you need about 5 to 10 seeds from the wood rose plant to start tripping out. But much smaller concentrations in the Morning Glory seeds, you need about 150 different seeds. To give you a shorter trip, it's about 4 or 5 hours, but it's essentially similar to an LSD trip. And the things that we know about this particular chemical is that these are some of the things that have been reported. And one of the concerns I would have would be that third one down, the feelings of sinking into nothingness. And what might happen with people who might, for example, have a history of depression, and how that might interfere with them in terms of their mental behaviour and mental condition. Because there are reports going back to the 1960s of suicide after people take consuming Morning Glory seeds. And that's one of the concerns that we have about these materials. Another plant that has religious connotations is a cactus called peyote. And this is the peyote cactus. This is the drug that Aldous Huxley wrote about when he wrote this famous book on drugs called The Doors of Perception. That by taking peyote, this cactus, and the chemical in it, a hallucinogenic amphetamine called mescaline, that you opened the doors of perception within your mind. How he heard about this is that slices of cactus, of this cactus, are consumed by Native American Indians in the United States instead of communion bread as part of their religious observance. They're members of a church called the Native American Church that actually has a legal exemption from the American drug laws to allow them use this cactus as part of their religious observance. And the idea again is that you hallucinate under the influence of the mescaline and that's a form of communion with God. But it's become a sort of pseudo-Eucharistic rite. It's become semi-Christianized in that Native American church. The point in relation to headshops is that headshops sell two other cacti that contain the same drug as peyote. One of them is called the San Pedro cactus. The other is called Peruvian torch. They're sold both that the living cacti are sold, which is difficult to object to because you can't close down every garden centre in the country that sells cacti. But they also sell the dried cactus, which is technically a preparation of the cactus that you either consume in dry form or more usually make a tea and drink a tea to induce the mescaline-containing hallucinogenic effects. And particularly the San Pedro contains much more mescaline than the peyote cactus. Now, you do have to be, in terms of the religious thing, you do have to be fairly devoted, member of that church, because the initial effect of taking the cactus is nausea and vomiting. And then you have to put up with that before you start hallucinating. So it's not something that I think would recommend it to a lot of people, but they seem to have plenty of sales through the head shops. Kratom is another of these herbal pies that they're selling. This is a plant that grows in Thailand particularly, and it's used in Thailand as a narcotic and as a substitute for opium. And it's, the chemicals in it are unusual in that if you take low doses of them, you get a stimulant effect. If you take high doses, you get a sedative effect. And it's a sort of strange thing that you're half awake, half asleep, and you get this dreaming, this lucid dreaming, where you appear to be awake, but you're actually dreaming under the influence of the drug. Now, the head shops are selling a whole range. These are just some of the different Kratom products that are on sale. And when you just see one brand on sale, you say, well, it's not a big issue. But when you see about these, there's four of about 20 different products being advertised on that Irish Head Store's website, then you say, there's a market for this stuff. People are using it. Now this stuff, Kratom, has been banned in Thailand, been banned in Burma, in Malaysia, and in Australia because of the side effects, the psychotic reactions that people get when they do it on a regular basis, the dependence and the withdrawal symptoms, the quite painful withdrawal symptoms that you get when you use the drug on a regular basis. Another South American, or more correctly Mexican, plant that's on sale in the head shops is this salvia. It's a type of sage. It's sold either as the strong concentrated extract of the leaf material. So you get 10x, 10 times normal strength, 15 times normal strength, 20 times normal strength. And then there's another one, 35 times normal strength. And it's also then sold in ready-made joints for smoking. You see the one top on the top left of that little insert with the products. Now this is known as magic mint or divine mint. And the reason why it's called divine mint, because it was used for, and still is used, in central Mexico by a tribe called the Mazatec Indians. It's used for religious purposes. And this, along with LSD, would be the strongest known hallucinogenic material. It's roughly the same potency as LSD. And it's unusual in that it's chemically different. The chemicals in it are different the dose that you find in LSD, but it has almost the same effects as LSD. It's legally controlled in a number of different countries. They've just decided that they do not want this material on sale. And the things that people look for when either they smoke this in joint form or chew it, so that you get the trip, the fact that you get this feeling of depersonalization, of being outside your own body, of losing contact with reality. And the thing that users don't like is that it only lasts for about 15 minutes. But they don't like the come down, the some of the nasty effects, the decreased ability to interact with themselves and their surroundings, the mental slowing, and the paranoia, the feelings of being persecuted that they get when they come down from the drug. And again, like with the other materials that I've talked about, it's this second one, the decreased ability to interact with yourself and your surroundings, is what makes this kind of drug dangerous. Because they're not particularly addictive. Like, nobody's going to become addicted to these, but it's the harm they do to themselves or others that makes them such a concern at the present time. Now, since the magic mushrooms have been taken away from the head shops, their bread and butter product has been the so-called party pills that contain this drug, BZP, which is sometimes claimed to be herbal. So it gives me the excuse to include it under the heading herbal highs, but it actually isn't. It's a synthetic drug. The last time I checked, now I don't go around head shops because suit, tie, grey hair, I stick out like a sore thumb. But did have students who would go in and buy these products that we would analyse in the lab. And also, I would monitor the websites to see what they're offering for sale on the website. So about 28 different products on the market, party pills containing BZP. These are just some of them. Fastlane, Frenzy, Freck, Hummer, Jax, the Shrooms, some of the other ones, they're mixtures of BZP and other products. Now that BZP stands for benzylpiperazine, and it's often mixed with a related compound called TFMPP. And sometimes you see on the label, it says contains piperazine blend. And what it means is it's a mix of BZP and the TFMPP. And the idea of this is that the TFMPP has weak LSD-like effects, and the BZP tends to have amphetamine speed type effects. So the idea of combining them is to give you something that is approaching the effects of ecstasy on the brain, which is why these are sold as a substitute, an alternative to ecstasy. Now, BZP was originally tested in the late 1960s, 1970s as an antidepressant drug. But the trials in humans were stopped because of the side effects. It was deemed to be unsuitable for human consumption because of the side effects, largely related to the fact that the effect on the brain was similar to that of amphetamine or speed. Okay. Now back to our pepper again. Remember I talked about black pepper, the piperine. One of the reasons why these products contain black pepper, or some of them contain isolated piperine, the chemical from black pepper, is that we know that black pepper increases the absorption of drugs from the stomach into the blood. So this is a very sophisticated approach to increasing the strength of these products by incorporating black pepper into it. That the blood level of these drugs would be much higher than it would otherwise be, because the black pepper, the piperine, is increasing the absorption of the drugs. So these people, I mean, what the guy called Bowden from New Zealand who discovered BZP did was he paid a pharmacologist to go through the scientific literature to find a drug that had these effects, but which wasn't then legally controlled. So it was quite a deliberate approach to producing these materials. Now, the EU has recently banned BZP, and the main reason for the ban is that these drugs affect the body in the same way as ecstasy does, and in the same way as amphetamine does. It increases the risk of heat stroke, hyperthermia, and you also get the effects, the speed-like effects, raised heartbeat and blood pressure. And in fact, in two studies with amphetamine addicts, they couldn't tell the difference between BZP and speed. The other thing for banning it was the life-threatening convulsions that were reported in the medical literature from New Zealand and from clubbers in the UK. The Department of Health and Children have until March of next year to ban it. They keep telling me that the ban is imminent, but the sooner the better, because there is significant amounts of BZB products being imported in anticipation of the ban. Some new products are appearing on the market. The most recent one I've come across on that website was a thing called Charlie's, and I'm not quite sure whether you can read it or not. It just says, contains BZP, and they said, the world's first drug harm minimization solution for cocaine. And when I read that, frankly, I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry or to get mad. So I settled for getting mad, because it's just outrageous. And then it says, do not use more than 2 capsules in 24 hours. Do not use if pregnant or breastfeeding. In fact, one of the products says, please consult your healthcare practitioner before using this product. Can you imagine the teenager going into their GP and says, is it all right if I use party pills? You know. Okay, so finish up. What can we do? Well, we can sit in our backside and do nothing, which is what we've been doing up to this. We've left these things set up all over the place, creating a feeling among young people that because these things are being sold over the counter, they're somehow legal and they're somehow safe, when they are not safe and they've never been shown to be safe. What we can do is to enforce the existing legislation in relation to some of the products, because they are controlled under the Misuse of Drugs Act, or they're prescription controlled, for example, ephedrine. The Morning Glories and the Woodrows are controlled under the Misuse of Drugs Act. Mescaline is controlled under the Misuse of Drugs Act. We talked about the skunk type seeds. And the other thing we could do immediately is to put a number of these plants on the prescription control list, which means that they couldn't be sold over the counter. And we've done this already in herbal terms with St. John's Wort, also with Ma Huang, and the other plant, Tribulus, is a Chinese plant that can be used instead of anabolic steroids. So we can do it that way. The real question is, do we want to? Are we quite happy to allow young people assume that it is safe and acceptable to change consciousness on a regular basis? Thank you very much.
Drugs.ie podcast.
Education and information.